An extraordinary mixture of emotions crossed Bonnet's face. Fury and astonishment preeminent among them. "Pick him up!" she repeated fiercely. He stood still, staring at her. Then, very slowly, he squatted, and gathering John Gray's limp form into his arms, got the point of his shoulder into Gray's abdomen and heaved him up.
"Come along, then," he said,
and without another glance at her, started off into the dark. She hesitated for a second, then seized the lantern and followed him. Within 50 feet, she smelled smoke. The brick corridor wasn't straight. It branched and turned, encompassing the many partitions of the cellar. But all the time it slanted down, heading toward the river bank. As they descended through the multiple turnings, the scent of smoke thickened. A layer of acrid haze swirled lazily around them, visible in the lantern light. Brianna held her breath, trying not to breathe. Bonnet was moving fast, despite Gray's weight. She could barely keep up, burdened with gun and lantern, but she didn't mean to give up either one just yet. Her belly tightened again, another of those breathless moments. "Not yet, I said," she muttered through gritted teeth. She had had to stop for a moment. Bonnet had disappeared into the haze ahead. Evidently he'd noticed the fading of the lantern light, though. She heard him bellow from somewhere up ahead. "Woman! Brianna!" "I'm coming!" she called, and hurried as fast as she could, waddling, discarding any pretense of grace. The smoke was much thicker, and she could hear a faint crackle somewhere in the distance. Overhead, before them. She was breathing heavily, in spite of the smoke. She drew in a ragged gulp of air and smelled water. Damp and mud, dead leaves and fresh air slicing through the smoky murk like a knife. A faint glow shone through the smoke and grew as they hurried toward it, dwarfing the light of her lantern. Then a dark square loomed ahead. Bonnet turned and seized her arm, dragging her out into the air. They were under the wharf, she realized. Dark water lapped ahead of them, brightness dancing on it. Reflection. The brightness came from up above. And so did the crackle of flame. Bonnet didn't stop or let go of her arm. He pulled her to one side, into the long, dank grass and mud of the bank. He let go within a few steps, but she followed, gasping for breath, slipping and sliding, tripping on the soggy edges of her skirts. At last he stopped in the shadow of the trees. He bent and let Gray's body slide to the ground. He stayed bent for a moment, chest heaving, trying to get his breath back. Brianna realized that she could see both men plainly, could see every bud on the twigs of the tree. She turned and looked back, to see the warehouse lighted like a jack-o'-lantern, flames licking through cracks in the wooden walls. The huge double doors had been left ajar. As she watched, the blast of hot air forced one open, and small tongues of fire began to creep across the dock, deceptively small and playful-looking. She felt a hand on her shoulder and whirled, looking up into Bonnet's face. "They've a ship waitin'," he said. "A little way upriver. Will you come with me, then?" She shook her head. She still held the gun, but didn't need it now. He was no threat to her. Still he didn't go, but lingered, staring down at her, a small frown between his brows. His face was gaunt, hollowed and shadowed by the distant fire. The surface of the river was aflame now, small tongues of fire flickering from the dark water as a slick of turpentine spread across it.
"Is it true?"
he asked abruptly. He asked no permission, but set his hands on her belly. It tightened at his touch, rounding in another of those breathless, painless squeezes, and a look of astonishment crossed his face.
She jerked away from his touch, pulling her cloak together, and nodded, unable to speak.
He seized her chin in his hand and peered into her face, assessing her truthfulness, perhaps. Then he let go and stuck a finger into his mouth, groping in the recesses of his cheek. He took her hand
and put something wet and hard in her palm.
"For his maintenance, then," he said, and grinned at her. "Take care of him, sweetheart."
And then he was gone, bounding long-legged up the riverbank, silhouetted like a demon in the flickering light. The turpentine flowing into the water had caught fire, and roiling billows of scarlet light shot upward, floating pillars of fire that lit the riverbank bright as day. She half raised the musket, finger on the trigger. He was no more than 20 yards away, a perfect shot.
"Not by your hand."
She lowered the gun and let him go. The warehouse was fully ablaze by now. The heat from it beat against her cheeks and blew the hair back from her face.
"I have a ship upriver," he'd said.
She squinted into the glare. The fire had nearly filled the river, a great floating slick that bloomed from bank to bank in a fiery garden of unfolding flames. Nothing could come through that blinding wall of light. Her other fist was still closed around the object he had given her. She opened her hand and looked down at the wet black diamond that gleamed in her palm, the fire growing red and bloody in its facets. Part 12. Je t'aime. Chapter 63. Forgiveness. River Run, May 1770. "That is the most stubborn woman I've ever met." Brianna huffed into the room like a ship in full sail and subsided onto the love seat by the bed, billowing. Lord John Grey opened one eye, bloodshot under his turban of bandages.
"Your aunt?"
"Who else?"
"You have a looking-glass in your room, do you not?"
His mouth curved, and after a reluctant moment, so did hers. "It's her bloody will. I told her I don't want River Run. I can't own slaves, but she won't change it. She just smiles as though I were a 6-year-old having a tantrum and says by the time it happens I'll be glad of it. Glad of it." She snorted and flounced into a more comfortable position. "What am I going to do?"
"Nothing."
"Nothing?" She turned the force of her displeasure on him. "How can I do nothing?"
"To begin with, I should be extremely surprised if your aunt were not immortal. Several of that particular race of Scots seem to be. However,"
he waved a hand in dismissal,
"should this prove untrue, and should she persist in her delusions that you would prove a good mistress to River Run..."
"What makes you think I wouldn't?" she said, pride stung.
"You cannot run a plantation of this size without slaves, and you decline to own them for reasons of conscience, or so I was given to understand. Though a less likely Quaker I have never seen."
He narrowed his open eye, indicating the immense tent of purple-striped muslin in which she was swathed.
"Returning to the point at issue, or one of them, should you find yourself the unwilling recipient of a number of slaves, arrangements can undoubtedly be made to free them."
"Not in North Carolina? The Assembly..."
"No, not in North Carolina,"
he agreed patiently.
"If the occasion should arise and you find yourself in possession of slaves, you will simply sell them to me."
"But that's..."
"And I will take them to Virginia, where manumission is much less stringently controlled. Once they are freed, you will return my money. At this point, you will be totally destitute and lacking in property, which appears to be your chief desire, second only to preventing any possibility of personal happiness by ensuring that you cannot marry the man you love."
She pleated a handful of muslin between her fingers, frowning at the big sapphire that shone on her hand. "I promised I'd listen to him first." She cast a narrow eye at Lord John. "Though I still say it's emotional blackmail."
"So much more effective than any other kind," he agreed. "Almost worth a cracked pate to finally hold the whip hand on a Fraser."
She ignored this. "And I only said I'd listen. I still think when he knows everything, he'll... he can't." She put a hand on her enormous belly. "You couldn't, could you? Care? Really care, I mean.
for a child that wasn't yours? He moved higher on the pillow, grimacing slightly.
For the sake of its parent. I expect I could.
He opened both eyes and looked at her, smiling.
Indeed, I was under the impression that I'd been doing so for some time.
She looked momentarily blank before a tide of pink flowed up from the scooped neck of her bodice. She was charming when she blushed.
You mean me? Well, yes, but, I mean, I'm not a baby and you're not having to claim me as your own.
She gave him a direct blue look at odds with the lingering pinkness of her cheeks.
And I did hope it wasn't all for my father's sake.
He was quiet for a moment, then reached out and squeezed her hand.
No, it wasn't,
he said gruffly. He let go and lay back with a small groan.
Are you feeling worse? She asked anxiously. Shall I get you something? Some tea? A poultice?
No. It's only that blasted headache, he said. The light makes it throb.
He shut his eyes again.
Tell me, he said, without opening them. Why is it that you seem so convinced that a man could not care for a child unless it were the fruit of his loins? As it is, my dear, I did not mean to refer to you when I said I'd been doing such a thing myself. My son, my stepson, is in fact the son of my late wife's sister. By tragic accident, both of his parents died within a day of each other, and my wife Isabel and her parents raised him from babyhood. I married Isabel when Willie was 6 or so. So you see, there is no blood between us at all. And yet, were any man to impugn my affection for him, or to say he is not my son, I would call him out on the instant for it.
I see, she said after a moment. I didn't know that.
He cracked an eyelid. She was still twisting her ring, looking pensive.
I think,
she began, and glanced at him.
I think I'm not so worried about Roger and the baby. If I'm honest...
Heaven forfend you should be otherwise,
he murmured.
If I'm honest, she went on, glowering at him, I think I'm worried more about how it would be between us, between Roger and me.
She hesitated, then took the plunge.
I didn't know Jamie Fraser was my father, she said. Not all the time I was growing up. After the Rising, my parents were separated. They each thought the other was dead. And so my mother married again. I thought Frank Randall was my father. I didn't find out otherwise until after he died.
Ah.
He viewed her with increased interest.
And was this Randall cruel to you?
No. He was wonderful.
Her voice broke slightly, and she cleared her throat, embarrassed.
No, he was the best father I could have had. It's just that I thought my parents had a good marriage. They cared for each other. They respected each other. Well, I thought everything was fine.
Lord John scratched at his bandages. The doctor had shaved his head, a condition which, in addition to affronting his vanity, itched abominably.
I fail to see the difficulty as applied to your present situation.
She heaved a huge sigh.
Then my father died, and we found out that Jamie Fraser was still alive. My mother went to join him, and then I came, and it was different. I saw how they looked at each other. I never saw her look at Frank Randall that way, or him at her.
Ah, yes.
A small gust of bleakness swept through him. He'd seen that look once or twice. The first time he had wanted desperately to put a knife through Claire Randall's heart.
Do you know how rare such a thing is?
He asked quietly.
That peculiar sort of mutual passion.
The one-sided kind was common enough.
Yes.
She had half turned, her arm along the back of the love seat, and was looking out through the French doors over the burgeoning spread of the spring flower beds below.
The thing is, I think I had it, she said, even more quietly. For a little while. A very little while.
She turned her head and looked at him with eyes that let him see clear through her.
If I've lost it, then I have. I can live with that, or without it. But I won't live with an imitation of it. I couldn't stand that.
It looks like you may get me by default.
Brianna put the breakfast tray over his lap and collapsed heavily into the love seat, making the joints groan. Don't riddle with a sick man, he said, picking up a piece of toast. What do you mean?
Drusus just came racing into the cookhouse, saying he saw two riders coming down through Campbell's fields. He said he was sure one of them was my father. He said it was a big man with red hair. God knows there aren't that many like him.
Not many, no.
He smiled briefly, his eyes travelling over her.
So, two riders.
It must be Dar and my mother. So they haven't found Roger. Or they did, and he didn't want to come back.
She twisted the big sapphire on her finger.
Good thing I have a fallback, isn't it?
Lord John blinked and made haste to swallow his mouthful of toast.
If by that extraordinary metaphor you mean that you intend to marry me after all, I assure you...
No.
She gave him a half-hearted smile.
Just teasing.
Oh, good.
He took a gulp of tea, closing his eyes to enjoy the fragrant steam.
Two riders? Did your cousin not go with them?
Yes, he did, she said slowly. God, I hope nothing's happened to Ian.
It might be that they experienced any variety of disasters on the journey, which obliged your cousin and your mother to travel behind your father and Mr. Mackenzie. Or your cousin and Mackenzie behind your parents.
He waved a hand, indicating innumerable possibilities.
I guess you're right.
She still looked piqued, and Lord John suspected she had cause. Comforting possibilities were all very well for the short term, but the colder probabilities were inclined to triumph over the longer course, and whoever accompanied Jamie Fraser, they would be arriving shortly with the answers to all questions. He pushed back the unfinished breakfast and leaned back against his pillows.
Tell me, how far does your remorse extend for having nearly gotten me killed?
She coloured and looked uncomfortable.
What do you mean?
If I ask you to do something you do not wish to, will your sense of guilt and obligation compel you to do it nonetheless?
Oh, more blackmail. What is it? She asked warily.
Forgive your father, whatever has happened.
Pregnancy had made her complexion more delicate. All her emotions ebbed and flowed just under the surface of that apricot skin. A touch would bruise her. He reached out and laid a hand very gently along her cheek.
For your sake, as well as his, he said.
I already have.
Her lashes covered her eyes as she looked down. Her hands lay still in her lap, the blue fire of his sapphire glowing on her finger. The sound of hooves came clearly through the open French doors, rattling on the gravel drive.
Then I think you had better go down and tell him so, my dear.
She pursed her lips and nodded. Without a word, she stood up and floated out the door, disappearing like a storm cloud over the horizon.
When we heard that there were two riders coming, and one of them Jamie, we feared lest something had happened to your nephew or Mackenzie. Somehow, it occurred to neither of us to think that anything had happened to you.
I'm immortal,
she murmured, peering alternately into his eyes. Didn't you know? The pressure of her thumbs lifted from his eyelids, and he blinked, still feeling her touch.
You have a slight enlargement of one pupil, but very small. Grip my fingers and squeeze as hard as you can.
She held out her index fingers, and he obliged, annoyed to feel the weakness of his grip.
Did you find Mackenzie?
He was further annoyed not to be able to control his curiosity. She gave him a quick, wary glance from those sherry-coloured eyes, and returned her gaze to his hands.
Yes, he'll be coming along a little later.
Will he?
She caught the tone of his question and hesitated, then looked at him directly.
How much do you know?
Everything, he said,
and had the momentary satisfaction of seeing her startled.
Then one side of her mouth curved up.
Everything?
Enough, he amended sardonically. Enough to ask whether your statement of Mr. Mackenzie's return is knowledge on your part or wishful thinking.
Call it faith.
Without so much as a by your leave, she tugged loose the strings of his nightshirt and spread it open, exposing his chest. Rolling a sheet of parchment deftly into a tube, she applied one end of it to his breast, putting her ear to the other end.
I beg your pardon, madam.
Hush! I can't hear, she said, making small shushing motions with one hand.
She proceeded to move her tube to different parts of his chest, pausing now and then to thump experimentally or prod him in the liver.
Have you moved your bowels yet today? She inquired, poking him familiarly in the abdomen.
I decline to say, he said, pulling his nightshirt back together with dignity.
She looked more outrageous even than usual. The woman must be 40 at least, yet she showed no more sign of age than a fine webbing of lines at the corners of her eyes, and threadings of silver in that ridiculous mass of hair. She was thinner than he remembered, though it was hard to judge of her figure, dressed as she was in a barbaric leather shirt and trouserings. She had plainly been in the sun and weather for some time. Her face and hands had baked a delicate soft brown that made the big golden eyes that much more startling when they turned full on one, which they now did.
Brianna says that Dr. Fentiman she find your skull.
He shifted uncomfortably under the sheets.
I'm told that he did. I'm afraid I was not aware of it at the time.
Her mouth quirked slightly. Just as well. Would you mind if I look at it?
It's only curiosity,
she went on with unaccustomed delicacy. Not medical necessity. It's only that I've never seen a trepanation. He closed his eyes, giving up.
Beyond the state of my bowels, I have no secrets from you, madam.
He tilted his head, indicating the location of the hole in his head, and felt her cool fingers slide under the bandage, lifting the gauze, and allowing a breath of air to soothe his hot head.
Brianna is with her father, he asked,
eyes still closed.
Yes.
Her voice was softer.
She told me, us, a little of what you'd done for her. Thank you.
The fingers left his skin, and he opened his eyes.
It was my pleasure to be of service to her, perforated skull and all.
She smiled faintly.
Jamie will be up to see you in a bit. He's talking to Brianna in the garden.
He felt a small stab of anxiety.
Are they in accord?
See for yourself.
She put an arm behind him, and with amazing strength for a woman with such fine bones, levered him upright. Just beyond the balustrade, he could see the two figures at the bottom of the garden, heads close together.
As he watched, they embraced, then broke apart, laughing at the awkwardness caused by Brianna's shape. I think we got here just in time. Claire murmured, looking at her daughter with a practiced eye. It isn't going to be much longer.
I confess to some gratitude at your prompt arrival, he said,
letting her ease him back onto the pillows and smooth his bedding.
I've barely survived the experience of being your daughter's nursemaid. I fear serving as her midwife would finish me completely.
Oh, I nearly forgot.
Claire reached into a nasty-looking leather pouch around her neck.
Brianna said to give this back to you. She won't need it any more.
He held out his hand, and a tiny spark of brilliant blue fell into his palm.
Jilted, by God, he said,
and grinned.
Chapter 64.
Bottom of the ninth.
It's like baseball, I assured her. Long stretches of boredom punctuated by short periods of intense activity.
She laughed, then stopped abruptly, grimacing.
Oh, intense, yeah. Whew!
She smiled a little lopsidedly.
At least at baseball games you get to drink beer and eat hot dogs in the boring parts.
Jamie, grasping at the only part of this conversation that made sense, leaned forward.
"There's a crock of small beer cool in the pantry," he said, peering anxiously at Brianna. "Will I fetch it in?"
"No," I said. "Not unless you want some. Alcohol wouldn't be good for the baby."
"Ah, what about the hot dog?"
He stood up and flexed his hands, obviously preparing to dash out and shoot one.
"It's a sort of sausage in a roll," I said, rubbing my upper lip in an effort not to laugh.
I glanced at Brianna.
I don't think she wants one.
Small beads of sweat had popped out quite suddenly on her wide brow, and she was looking white around the eye sockets.
"Oh, barf," she said faintly.
Correctly interpreting this remark from the look on her face, Jamie hastily applied the damp cloth to her face and neck.
"Put your head between your knees, lass."
She glared at him ferociously.
"I can't get my head near my knees," she said, teeth clenched.
Then the spasm relaxed, and she took a deep breath, the colour coming back into her face. Jamie glanced from her to me, frowning worriedly. He took a hesitant step toward the door.
"I expect I'd best go then, if you—"
"Don't leave me."
"But it's, I mean, you've your mother and—"
"Don't leave me," she repeated.
Agitated, she leaned over and grabbed his arm, shaking it for emphasis.
"You can't. You said I wouldn't die."
She was staring intently into his face.
"If you stay, it will be all right. I won't die."
She spoke with such intensity that I felt a sudden spasm of fear clutch my own innards, hard as the pain of labour. She was a big girl, strong and healthy. She should have no great trouble delivering. But I was large enough, healthy as well, and 25 years before I had lost a stillborn child at 6 months, and nearly died myself. I might be able to protect her from childbed fever, but there was no defence against a sudden hemorrhage. The best I could do under such circumstances would be to try to save her child via caesarean section. I resolutely kept my eyes off the chest in which the sterile blade lay ready, just in case.
"You're not going to die, Bree," I said.
I spoke as soothingly as I could and put a hand on her shoulder, but she must have felt the fear under my professional façade. Her face twisted, and she grabbed my hand, clinging so tightly that the bones rubbed together. She closed her eyes and breathed through her nose, but didn't cry out. She opened her eyes and looked straight at me, her pupils dilated so that she seemed to be looking past me into a future that only she could see.
"If I do,"
she said, putting a hand to her swollen belly. Her mouth worked, but whatever she'd been meaning to say couldn't force its way out. She struggled to her feet then, and leaned heavily on Jamie, her face muffled in his shoulder, repeating,
"Da, don't leave me, don't."
"I will not leave you, Lerman. Dinna be afraid. I'll stay with you."
He put an arm around her, looking helplessly over her head at me.
"Walk her," I said to Jamie, seeing her restlessness. "Like a horse with colic," I added, as he looked blank.
That made her laugh. With the ginger air of a man approaching an armed bomb, he put an arm around her waist and towed her slowly around the room. Given their respective sizes, it sounded a lot like someone leading a horse, too.
"All right,"
I heard him ask anxiously on one circuit.
"I'll tell you when I'm not," she assured him.
It was warm for mid-May. I opened the windows wide, and the scents of phlox and columbine flowed in, mixed with the cool, damp air from the river. The house was filled with an air of expectation, eagerness with a hint of fear beneath. Jocasta walked up and down the terrace below, too nervous to stay put. Betty put her head in every few minutes to ask if anything was needed. Phèdre came up from the pantry with a jug of fresh buttermilk just in case. Brianna, her eyes focused inwardly, merely shook her head at it. I sipped a glass myself, mentally checking off the preparations. The fact was that there wasn't a hell of a lot you needed to do for a normal birth, and not the hell of a lot you could do if it wasn't. The bed was stripped and old quilts laid to protect the mattress. There was a stack of clean cloths to hand, and a can of hot water, renewed every half hour or so from the kitchen copper. Cool water for sipping and brow mopping, a small vial of oil for rubbing, my suture kit to hand just in case. And beyond that, everything was up to Brianna. After nearly an hour's walking, she stopped dead in the middle of the floor, gripping Jamie's arm and breathing through her nose like a horse at the end of a 20-furlong race. "I want to lie down," she said. Phèdre and I got her gown off and got her safely onto the bed in her shift. I laid my hands on the huge mound of her belly, marvelling at the sheer impossibility of what had happened already and what was about to happen next. The rigidity of the contraction passed off, and I could clearly feel the curves of the child below the thin, rubbery covering of skin and muscle. It was large, I could tell that, but it seemed to be lying well, head down and fully engaged. Normally, babies about to be born were fairly quiet, intimidated by the upheaval of their surroundings. This one was stirring. I felt a small, distinct surge against my hand as an elbow poked out. "Daddy!" Brianna reached out blindly, flailing as a contraction took her unaware. Jamie lunged forward and caught her hand, squeezing tight.
"I'm here, Avianacht. I'm here."
She breathed heavily, face bright red, then relaxed and swallowed. "How long?" she asked. She was facing me, but not looking at me. She wasn't looking at anything outside. "I don't know. Not an awfully long time, I don't think." The contractions were roughly 5 minutes apart, but I knew they could continue like that for a long time, or speed up abruptly. There was simply no telling. There was a light breeze from the window, but she was sweating. I wiped her face and neck again, and rubbed her shoulders. "You're doing fine, lovey," I murmured to her. "Just fine." I glanced up at Jamie and smiled. "So are you." He made a game try at returning the smile. He was sweating too, but his face was white, not red.
"Talk to me, da," she said suddenly.
"Ugh."
He looked at me, frantic.
"What shall I see?"
"It doesn't matter," I said. "Tell her stories. Anything to take her mind off things."
"Oh, ah. Well, you have heard the one about Habitrot, the spinstress?"
Brianna grunted in reply. Jamie looked apprehensive, but started in nonetheless.
"Aye, well, it happened that in an old farmhouse that stood by the river there lived a fair maid called Maisie. She'd red hair and blue een, and was the bonniest maid in all the valley. But she had no husband because—"
He stopped, appalled. I glared at him. He coughed and went on, plainly not knowing what else to do.
"Because in those days men were sensible, and instead of looking for lovely lasses to be their brides, they looked out for girls who could cook and spin, who might make notable housewives. But Maisie—"
Brianna made a deep, inhuman noise. Jamie clenched his teeth for a moment, but went on, holding tight to both her hands.
"But Maisie loved the light in the fields and the birds of the glen."
The light faded gradually from the room, and the smell of sun-warmed flowers was replaced by the damp green smell of the willows by the river, and the faint scent of wood smoke from the cookhouse. Brianna's shift was wet through and stuck to her skin. I dug my thumbs into her back, just above the hips, and she squirmed hard against me, trying to ease the ache. Jamie sat with his head down, clinging doggedly to her hands, still talking soothingly, telling stories of silkies and seal catchers, of pipers and elves, of the great giants of Fingal's Cave, and the devil's black horse that passes through the air faster than the thought between a man and a maid. The panes were very close together. I motioned to Phaedra, who ran away and came back with a lighted taper to light the candles in the sconces. It was cool and dim in the room, the walls lit with flickering shadows. Jamie's voice was hoarse. Brianna's was nearly gone. Suddenly she let go of him and sat up, grabbing at her knees, face dark red with effort, pushing. "Now then," I said. I stacked pillows quickly behind her, made her lean back against the bedstead, called Phaedra to hold the candlestick for me. I oiled my fingers, reached under her shift, and touched flesh I hadn't touched since she was a baby herself. I rubbed slowly, gently, talking to her, knowing it made no great difference what I said. I felt the strain, the sudden change under my fingers, a relaxation, then once more. There was a sudden gush of amniotic fluid that splashed across the bed and dripped on the floor, filling the room with the scent of fecund rivers. I rubbed and eased, praying that it wouldn't come too fast, not tear her. The ring of flesh opened suddenly, and my fingers touched something wet and hard. Relaxation, and it moved back, away, leaving the ends of my fingers tingling with the knowledge that I had touched someone entirely new. Once more the great pressure, the stretching came, and once more eased slowly back. I pushed back the edge of the shift, and with the next push the ring stretched to impossible size, and a head like a Chinese gargoyle popped out, with a flood of amniotic fluid and blood. I found myself nose to nose with a waxy white head with a face like a fist that grimaced at me in utter fury.
"What is it? Is it a boy?"
Jamie's hoarse question cut through my startlement. "I hope so," I said, hastily thumbing mucus from nose and mouth. "It's the ugliest thing I've ever seen. God help it if it's a girl." Brianna made a noise that might have started as a laugh and turned into an enormous grunt of effort. I barely had time to get my fingers in and turn the wide shoulders slightly to help. There was an audible pop, and a long, wet form slithered out onto the soggy quilt, wriggling like a landed trout. I seized a clean linen towel and wrapped him. It was him. The scrotal sac swelled up round and purple between fat thighs, checking quickly for his apgar signs. Breathing, colour, activity, all good. He was making thin, angry noises, short explosions of breath, not really crying, and punching the air with clenched tiny fists. I laid him on the bed, one hand on the bundle as I checked Brianna. Her thighs were smeared with blood, but there was no sign of hemorrhage. The cord was still pulsing, a thick, wet snake of connection between them. She was panting, lying back on the crushed pillows, hair plastered wetly to her temples, an enormous smile of relief and triumph on her face. I laid a hand on her belly, suddenly flaccid. Deep inside I felt the placenta give way as her body surrendered its last physical link with her son. "Once more, honey," I said softly to her. The last contraction shivered over her belly, and the afterbirth slid out. I tied off the cord and cut it, and placed the solid little bundle of her child in her arms. "He's beautiful," I whispered. I left him to her and turned my attention to immediate matters, kneading her belly firmly with my fists to encourage the uterus to contract and stop the bleeding. I could hear the babble of excitement spreading through the house as Phaedra rushed downstairs to spread the news. I glanced upward once, to see Brianna glowing, still smiling from ear to ear. Jamie was behind her, also smiling, his cheeks wet with tears. He said something to her in husky Gaelic, and brushing the hair away from her neck, leaned forward and kissed her gently just behind the ear.
"Is he hungry?"
Brianna's voice was deep and cracked, and she tried to clear her throat.
"Shall I feed him?"
"Try him and see. Sometimes they're sleepy right afterward, but sometimes they want to nurse." She fumbled at the neck of her shift and pulled loose the ribbon, bearing one high, full breast. The bundle made small gruff noises as she turned it awkwardly toward her, and her eyes sprang open in surprise as the mouth fastened on her nipple with sudden ferocity.
"Strong, isn't he?" I said,
and realized that I was crying only when I tasted the salt of my tears running into the corners of my smile. Some time later, with mother and child cleaned up and made comfortable, food and drink brought for Brianna, and a last check assuring that all was well, I walked out into the deep shadows of the upper gallery. I felt pleasantly detached from reality, as though I were walking a foot or so off the ground. Jamie had gone down to tell John. He was waiting for me at the foot of the stairs. He drew me into his arms without a word and kissed me. As he let me go, I saw the deep red crescents of Brianna's nail marks on his hands, not yet faded.
"You're dead brawly too," he whispered to me.
Then the joy in his eyes bloomed bright and flowered in a face-splitting grin.
"Granny."
"Is he dark or fair?" Jamie asked suddenly, rising on one elbow beside me in bed.
"I counted his fingers and I didn't even think to look."
"You can't really tell yet," I said drowsily. I'd counted his toes, and I'd thought of it. "He's sort of reddish-purple, and he's still got the vernix, the white stuff, all over him. It will probably be a day or two before his skin fades into a natural colour. He's got just a bit of dark hair, but it's the sort that rubs off soon after birth." I stretched, enjoying the pleasant ache in legs and back. Labour was hard work, even for the midwife.
"It wouldn't prove anything, even if he were fair, since Brianna is.
He could be either way."
"Aye, but if he were dark, we'd know for sure."
"Maybe not. Your father was dark, so was mine. He could have recessive genes and come out dark, even if..."
"He could have what?"
I tried without success to think whether Gregor Mendel had yet started messing about with his pea plants, but gave up the effort, too sleepy to concentrate. Whether he had or not, Jamie evidently hadn't heard of him. "He could be any colour and we wouldn't know for sure," I said. I yawned widely. "We won't know until he gets old enough to start resembling somebody. And even then..." I trailed off. Did it matter a great deal who his father had been, if he wasn't going to have one? Jamie rolled toward me and scooped me into a spooned embrace. We slept naked, and the hair on his body brushed against my skin. He kissed me softly on the back of the neck and sighed, his breath warm and tickling on my ear. I hovered on the edge of sleep, too happy to fall completely over into dreams. Somewhere nearby, I heard a small, stifled squawk and the murmur of voices.
"I will,"
Jamie's voice roused me some moments later. He sounded defiant.
"If I dinna ken his father, at least I'm sure who his grandsire is."
I reached back and patted his leg.
"So am I, Grandpa. Hush up and go to sleep.
Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof." He snorted, but his arms relaxed around me, hand curved on my breast, and in moments he was asleep. I lay wide-eyed, watching stars through the open window. Why had I said that? It was Frank's favourite quotation, one he always used to soothe Brianna or me when we worried over things.
"Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof."
The air in the room was live. A light breeze stirred the curtains, and coolness touched my cheek.
"Do you know," I whispered soundless, "do you know she has a son?"
There was no answer, but peace came gradually over me in the quiet of the night, and I fell at last over the edge of dreams.
Chapter 65. Return to Fraser's Ridge. Jocasta was loath to part with her newest relative, but the spring planting was already very late, and the homestead sadly neglected. We needed to return to the ridge without delay, and Brianna wouldn't hear of staying behind. Which was a good thing, as it would have taken dynamite to separate Jamie from his grandson. Lord John was well enough to travel. He came with us as far as the Great Buffalo Trail Road, where he kissed Brianna and the baby, embraced Jamie, and, to my shock, me, before turning north toward Virginia and Willie.
"I'll trust you to take care of them," he said quietly to me, with a nod toward the wagon, where two bright heads bent together in mutual absorption over the bundle in Brianna's lap.
"You may," I said, and pressed his hand. "I'll trust you, too."
He lifted my hand to his lips, briefly, smiled at me, and rode away without looking back. A week later, we bumped over the grass-choked ruts to the ridge where the wild strawberries grew, green and white and red together. Constancy and courage, sweetness and bitterness mingled in the shadows of the trees. The cabin was dirty and uncared for, its sheds empty and full of dead leaves. The garden was a tangle of old dried stalks and random shoots, the paddock an empty shell. The framework of the new house stood black and skeletal, reproachful on the ridge. The place looked barely habitable, a ruin. I had never felt such joy in any homecoming, ever.
"Name," I wrote, and paused. God knew, I thought. His last name was open to question, his Christian name not yet even considered.
I called him Sweetie. Or darling. Lizzie called him dear lad. Jamie addressed him with Gaelic formality, either as grandson or Aruach, the red one, his dark infant fuzz and dusky skin having given way to a blazing fair ruddiness that made it clear to the most casual observer just who his grandsire was, whoever his father might have been. Brianna found no need to call him anything. She kept him always with her, guarding him with a fierce absorption that went beyond words. She wouldn't give him a formal name, she said. Not yet.
When?
Lizzie had asked, but Brianna didn't answer. I knew when. When Roger came.
And if he doesna come, said Jamie privately to me, I expect the poor wee lad will go to his grave with no name at all. Christ, that lass is stubborn.
She trusts Roger, I said evenly. You might try to do the same. He gave me a sharp look.
There is a difference between trust and hope, Sassenach, and you ken that as well as I do.
Well, have a stab at hope, then, why don't you? I snapped, and turned my back on him, dipping my quill and shaking it elaborately. Little Query Mark had a rash on his bottom that had kept him and everyone else in the house awake all night. I was grainy-eyed and cross, and not inclined to tolerate any show of bad faith.
Jamie walked deliberately around the table and sat down opposite me, resting his chin on his folded arms so that I was forced to look at him.
"I would," he said,
a shadow of humour in his eyes,
"if I could decide whether to hope he comes or hope he does not."
I smiled, then reached across and ran the feathered tip of my quill down the bridge of his nose in token forgiveness, before returning to my work. He wrinkled his nose and sneezed, then sat up straight, peering at the paper.
"What's that you're doing, Sassenach?"
"Making out little Gizmo's birth certificate, so far as I can," I added.
"Gizmo?"
he said doubtfully.
"That will be a saint's name."
"I shouldn't think so, though you never know. What with people named Pantaleone and Onophrius or Ferriolus."
"Ferriolus?" I dinna think I ken that one.
He leaned back, hands linked over his knee.
One of my favourites, I told him, carefully filling in the birth date and time of birth. Even that was an estimate, poor thing. There were precisely two bits of unequivocal information on this birth certificate, the date and the name of the doctor who delivered him.
Ferreolus, I went on with some enjoyment, is the patron saint of sick poultry. Christian martyr. He was a Roman tribune and a secret Christian. Having been found out, he was chained up in the prison cesspool to await trial. I suppose the cells must have been full. Sounds rather a daredevil. He slipped his chains and escaped through the sewer. They caught up with him, though, dragged him back and beheaded him.
Jamie looked blank.
What has that got to do with chickens?
I haven't the faintest idea. Take it up with the Vatican, I advised him.
Mm-hmm. Ah, well, I've always been fond of St. Guignol myself.
I could see the glint in his eye, but couldn't resist. And what's he the patron of?
He's invoked against impotence.
The glint got stronger.
I saw a statue of him in Brest once. They did say it had been there for 1,000 years. 'Twas a miraculous statue. It had a cock like a gun muzzle and...
A what? Well, the size wasn't the miraculous bit, he said, waving me to silence.
Or not quite. The townsfolk say that for 1,000 years, folk have whittled away bits of it as holy relics. And yet the cock is still as big as ever.
He grinned at me.
They do say that a man with a bit of St. Guignol in his pocket can last a night and a day without tiring.
Not with the same woman, I don't imagine, I said dryly. It does rather make you wonder what he did to merit sainthood, though, doesn't it? He laughed.
Any man who's had his prayer answered could tell you that, Sassenach.
He swiveled on his stool, looking out the open door. Brianna and Lizzie sat on the grass, skirts blooming around them, watching the baby, who lay naked on an old shawl on his stomach, red-arsed as a baboon. Brianna Ellen, I wrote neatly, then paused. Brianna Ellen Randall, do you think? I asked. Or Fraser? Or both? He didn't turn around, but his shoulder moved in the faintest of shrugs.
Does it matter?
It might.
I blew across the page, watching the shiny black letters go dull as the ink dried. If Roger comes back, whether he stays or not, if he chooses to acknowledge Little Anonymous, I suppose his name will be Mackenzie. If he doesn't or won't, then I imagine the baby takes his mother's name. He was silent for a moment, watching the two girls. They had washed their hair in the creek that morning. Lizzie was combing out Brianna's mane, the long strand shimmering like red silk in the summer sun.
"She calls herself Fraser," he said softly. "Or she did."
I put down my quill and reached across the table to lay a hand on his arm.
"She's forgiven you," I said. "You know she has."
His shoulders moved, not quite a shrug, but the unconscious attempt to ease some inner tightness.
"For now," he said. "But if the man doesna come?"
I hesitated. He was quite right. Brianna had forgiven him for his original mistake. Still, if Roger didn't appear soon, she would be bound to blame Jamie for it. Not without reason, I was forced to admit.
"Use both," he said abruptly. "Let her choose."
I didn't think he meant last names.
"He'll come," I said firmly. "And it will be all right."
I picked up the quill and added, not quite under my breath, "I hope." He stooped to drink, the water splashing over dark green rock. It was a warm day, spring now, not autumn, but the moss was still emerald green underfoot. The memory of a razor was far behind him. His beard was thick, and his hair hung past his shoulders. He'd bathed in a creek the night before, and done his best to wash himself and his clothes, but he had no illusions about his appearance. Neither did he care, he told himself.
What he looked like didn't matter.
He turned toward the path where he had left his horse, limping. His foot ached, but that didn't matter either. He rode slowly through the clearing where he had first met Jamie Fraser. The leaves were new and green, and in the distance he could hear the raucous calling of the ravens. Nothing stirred among the trees but the wild grasses. He breathed deep and felt a stab of memory, a broken remnant from a past life, a shard sharp as glass. He turned his horse's head toward the top of the ridge and urged it on, kicking gently with his good foot. Soon now. He had no idea what his reception might be, but that didn't matter. Nothing mattered now, save the fact that he was here. Chapter 66. Child of My Blood. Some enterprising rabbit had dug its way under the stakes of my garden again. One voracious rabbit could eat a cabbage down to the roots, and from the looks of things he'd brought friends. I sighed and squatted to repair the damage, packing rocks and earth back into the hole. The loss of Ian was a constant ache. At such moments as this I missed his horrible dog as well. I had brought a large collection of cuttings and seeds from River Run, most of which had survived the journey. It was mid-June, still time, barely, to put in a fresh crop of carrots. The small patch of potato vines was all right, so were the peanut bushes. Rabbits wouldn't touch those, and didn't care for the aromatic herbs either, except the fennel, which they gobbled like licorice. I wanted cabbages, though, to preserve as sauerkraut. Come midwinter, we would want food with some taste to it, as well as some vitamin C. I had enough seed left, and could raise a couple of decent crops before the weather turned cold, if I could keep the bloody rabbits off. I drummed my fingers on the handle of my basket, thinking. The Indians scattered clippings of their hair around the edges of the fields, but that was more protection against deer than rabbits. Jamie was the best repellent, I decided. Nyawenny had told me that the scent of carnivore urine would keep rabbits away, and a man who ate meat was nearly as good as a mountain lion, to say nothing of being more biddable. Yes, that would do. He'd shot a deer only 2 days ago. It was still hanging. I should brew a fresh bucket of spruce beer to go with the roast venison, though. As I wandered through the herb shed to see if I had any maypop fruits for flavouring, my eye caught a movement at the far edge of the clearing. Thinking it was Jamie, I turned to go and inform him of his new duty, only to be stopped dead in my tracks when I saw who it was. He looked worse than he had the last time I'd seen him, which was saying quite a bit. He was hatless, hair and beard a glossy black tangle, and his clothes hung on him in tatters. He was barefoot, one foot wrapped in a bundle of filthy rags, and he limped badly. He saw me at once and stopped while I came up to him.
"I'm glad it's you," he said. "I wondered who had meat first."
His voice sounded soft and rusty, and I wondered whether he had spoken to a living soul since we'd left him in the mountains.
"Your foot, Roger."
"It doesn't matter."
He gripped my arm.
"Are they all right? The baby? And Brianna?"
"They're fine. Everybody's in the house."
His head turned toward the cabin, and I added, "You have a son." He jerked sharply back toward me, green eyes wide with startlement.
"He's mine. I have a son."
"I suppose you do," I said. "You're here, aren't you?"
The look of startlement and hope, I realized, faded slowly. He looked into my eyes and seemed to see how I felt, for he smiled, not easily, no more than a painful lifting of the corner of his mouth. But he smiled.
"I'm here," he said,
and turned toward the cabin and its open doorway. Jamie sat in his rolled-up shirt sleeves at the table, shoulder to shoulder with Brianna, frowning at a set of house drawings as she pointed with her quill. Both of them were liberally covered with ink, being inclined to enthusiasm when discussing architecture.
The baby snored peacefully in his cradle nearby. Brianna was rocking it absently with one foot. Lizzie was spinning by the window, humming softly under her breath as the great wheel went round.
"Very domestic,"